This is Bristol Band Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, April 8th. I'm Dave Bettinger. Thanks for joining us. Coming up this week, we'll see what some on the front lines tell us are the impacts of drug use in the area.
People trading sex for drugs. This is another huge, ugly secret about this drug, is that you will do anything.
We'll also look at how doctors are carefully prescribing the opiate painkillers at the Kanakanak Hospital.
If you treat someone's pain to the point that they have very little pain or no pain, you see a much faster development of tolerance and addiction.
Fish and Game's Tim Sands says he's taken feedback from drift fishermen to heart and will turn them loose on the flood tides next season.
The general message that we got at the Board of Fish meeting and at the advisory committee meeting was, we're not happy with what you're doing now because it's not enough flood. We want more flood.
A local artist reflects on the art community in Bristol Bay.
It'd be cool to have some young, sassy artists start really, you know, throwing some pizzazz out there, getting us motivated to do some stuff. I've slowed down a little bit since I had kids.
And before we go this week, we'll get some expert advice on good spring boat maintenance.
I'll turn the key on, see if we get a warning alarm. Yep, that's there. And I'll just blip the starter real quick to see if that starter motor's working, which it is.
Those stories are coming up after a look back at some of the week's news. Just before 10 p.m. last Friday night, a 6.2 magnitude quake shook near the Aniakchak crater on the Alaska Peninsula. Its effects were felt around Bristol Bay, most noticeably in nearby Port Hyden and the Chignicks. No damage was reported. State seismologist Michael West says he's doubtful of any connection between the series of quakes that struck the same area over the weekend and the eruption of Pavlov Volcano the week before.
The style of these earthquakes and their location really gives no indication at all that these have a volcanic origin. These are exactly the kinds of earthquakes that we expect along coastal Alaska, where the earth is basically being compressed.
West said the 6.2 quake was one of the largest recorded in that area in decades. The University of Alaska Anchorage Seawolves women's basketball team traveled to Indianapolis for the NCAA D2 championship game against Lubbock Christian last Monday. While the Seawolves came up short by 5 against LCU, they held their heads high after the program's first championship appearance. Retired EPA ecologist Phil North appeared for deposition last Friday. Speaking with KDLG News the same day, Pebble Mine says that North was central in leading the agency towards a proposed preemptive veto of the project under the Clean Water Act. North says that between 2005 and 2007, as he studied the area and the potential mine, he made up his mind that that was the logical thing to do.
It made sense to me that EPA should use its authority to just go ahead and upfront restrict the discharge of dredged or fill material into those wetlands and streams. And, of course, EPA had that authority under Section 404C of the Clean Water Act.
Hundreds of pages of North's 10 hours of deposition were made public over the weekend. Pebble has not said if they found anything in his testimony that will help or hurt their lawsuit against EPA. The Bristol Bay Heritage Land Trust and the Kalikanik Natives announced the finalization of a deal to put a conservation easement over some 570 acres at the confluence of Harris Creek on the Nooshigak River. Director Tim Troll says the land trust was able to pay about $100,000 and trade a 40-acre parcel it owned nearby to the Native Corporation in exchange for the easement.
Here's an area that was always probably intended to be used for and probably selected under the terms of ANCSA for its subsistence value. So that's not lost. So what they have basically given up and in essence sold is the right to put large development on the property.
Troll says the land trust is finalizing another large conservation easement deal near Pedro Bay to protect freshwater seal habitat. On our crime and safety beat, 29-year-old Lee Ludwig was sentenced to 2 years in jail and 4 years of probation for shooting at his parents' Iliamna home last August. 20-year-old Tyler Blue of Togiak has been charged with the first-degree rape of a Dillingham woman last October, and 27-year-old Alexandra Anguson has been charged with selling heroin to a Dillingham police confidential informant last January. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. Drugs are killing Americans at an alarming rate. U.S. health officials say drug overdose is now the leading cause of accidental death in the U.S., with 47,055 lethal overdoses reported in 2014. Opioids like heroin and oxycodone are driving the epidemic, killing an average of 78 people per day in this country. The epidemic has spread to every corner of the United States, including Southwest Alaska. This caller on Monday's open line on KDLG reminded us that this is an important topic to keep talking about.
But I haven't heard one word from any of these people who had a great deal of starting this whole thing getting kicked off with not being fully educated, I guess, on, you know, the dangers of the opiates and this and that. You know, I mean, you can't get a pill unless the doctor prescribes it to you. So I would just like to hear some stuff on the radio on how someone might be able to get some help.
This week I asked some people on the front lines in Dillingham about what they are seeing with drug abuse. Speaking of treatment options, Sherry Johansson, the program manager at Jake's Place, confirmed what many feel, that the options are few and hard to get into.
Yes, I think that's true. I know that there's a waiting list all around the state, especially with the increase in opiate use. A lot of people are trying to seek treatment. They've been going to the emergency room, trying to get into detox. A lot of people from Crystal Bay, I know in Dillingham, one individual that I helped out trying to get into a treatment center indicated that there was a long wait even to get to like opiate replacement therapy treatment centers.
Recently, the Bristol Bay Housing Authority discovered concerning amounts of needles and drug paraphernalia in unoccupied HUD homes and called in some health experts to help teach staff how to safely remove those. Among them was public health nurse Gina Carpenter, who also tells me she's concerned about another effect of needle use.
What we're seeing is people testing positive for hepatitis C. Hepatitis C is seen among people who share needles or drug paraphernalia. So that tells us that the behavior is increasing in our area and in our region because we're seeing more of these hepatitis C cases, and that's generally how that spread.
Karen Carpenter, the outreach coordinator at the Safe Shelter in Dillingham, says drug habits are clearly tearing families and relationships apart.
It gets very expensive very quickly, and all of a sudden there's no money for food, there's no money for oil, there's no money for lights, there's no money for child care, there's no money for anything, and the addiction pretty much just takes over the whole family. And so then other agencies get involved, like OCS or ICWA, to step in and help these kids. Problem is, we have a lack of foster homes, and if grandparents take them, that they're taking on a huge responsibility. Not that they don't love their grandchildren, they do, but it costs money.
To fund the habit, she adds that men and women both who have become addicted to heroin are stealing a lot from family, friends, and strangers. More concerning, she says, there is a growing sex trafficking trade.
The trafficking that we see more of, and this is pretty much across the board in Alaska, is people trading sex for drugs. This is another huge, ugly secret about this drug, is that you will do anything.
She and others say pregnant women are skipping prenatal exams because they're afraid it'll be discovered they're using drugs. Police say the use and trafficking, mainly of heroin, is going up, not down, and there appears to be more meth on the street. Enforcing it is tricky. Dan Pasquarello is Dillingham's police chief.
We work drug cases as often as we can, and our amount of productivity depends upon the quality of our informants. A lot of players in the heroin game have left town, gone either to Anchorage or other places. There's still a small contingent here in Dillingham. As far as how it, besides the addiction, how it affects other crimes, it may be behind theft cases that we investigate. But one thing I have noticed, though, is dealing with people that we've dealt with who had heroin problems in the past actually get kind of proud when they tell us that they're cleaning up. They'll go to treatment, say in Anchorage or something, and come back, and they're sort of proud that they're cleaning up their lives, and kind of makes us happy too.
While hard drugs have turned up in the schools over the past couple of years, Dillingham Middle and High School Principal Bill Schwann says that education, staff training, and suspensions and expulsions have helped curb it some.
I think our kids are much more knowledgeable today than you and I were, most definitely, and I think there's the lack of genuine concern that it's not going to happen to me. I get some of that just in talking with kids. But I would say I think we've pushed it outside of the school. I'm not a fool to think that it's not here, but it's not as prevalent as it was 4 years ago.
Okay, that's what some on the front lines had to say this week. While heroin is the most common illicit drug of choice in this area, it is believed that its prescription counterparts, drugs like oxycodone, hydrocodone, and methadone, have led to a number of deaths and addictions here and elsewhere around the state. Some feel that doctors around the country, even here in the region, overprescribed pain meds beginning in the early 90s and feel that's partly to blame for the epidemic of deaths today. To talk about pain, pain medications, and how the hospital carefully administers these treatments, I'm happy to be joined now by Dr. Mitch Horan from the Kanakanak Hospital.
It's good to have you in. Thanks for making time. Let's talk first briefly about the difference between chronic and terminal pain.
Yeah, it's a big distinction, and it's important. So terminal pain is somebody who is dying of a terminal disease. That's usually cancer. And when we're prescribing opiates for those people, we're not terribly concerned about tolerance and addiction. And so the main goal is just really good pain control so that they can enjoy their last few months or weeks and try to get through that comfortably. We understand in that process that they are going to be addicted, but in that situation, it's less important than good pain control. In the non-terminal patient, non-terminal pain patient, and we're talking about chronic pain here, that is a situation where somebody might have 40 more years of life. And so when we're prescribing there, there's a big concern about tolerance and addiction and how you're going to continue to control their pain over the rest of their life.
The goal there isn't pain-free, it's something else.
Yeah, and we try to get this across to patients. In that case, the goal is functional pain relief. If you treat someone's pain to the point that they have very little pain or no pain, you see a much faster development of tolerance and addiction. And that's obviously a big concern if you've got a non-terminal chronic pain patient. And so the goal is to get their pain under control so that they can function in their life. And unfortunately, they're still going to have some pain. But, you know, there are some positive things about pain. But, you know, that's going to be something they'll have to deal with.
There's a perception, I don't know if it's reality, that there was, at least for a time, the over-dispensing, the over-prescription of opiate pain medications that maybe has led to part of the epidemic in the country. This is nationwide, not just here. But in talking with you earlier, you say that BBAHC took a look at this about 5 years ago and came up with kind of a committee or policy.
Yeah, between 5 and 6 years ago, we set up a chronic opioid therapy committee. And that involves the med staff, the pharmacists, and physical therapy. And what we try to look at there is anybody who is getting chronic opiate therapy for non-terminal pain, we review their cases individually. We try to make sure they have good indications for chronic opiate therapy. We try to look at whether they are at high risk of addiction. And then we try to follow through and see if in the patients who have been placed on chronic opiate therapy, if that therapy is making a measurable difference in their life. Are they more functional? And the classic measure there is somebody who was unable to work before. Could they work now? It's not always that easy, but that one's kind of obvious.
Is this working in your mind? Is this an effective way of going about adding a layer of responsibility to the what we've realized are very addictive medications?
I think so. I think we would, and by we, I mean the medical staff, we would all agree that has helped. We have, if you look at the total number of narcotic prescriptions, opiates, what we're talking about, the number, you know, per patients, they're decreased. The number of patients receiving them is decreased during that period of time. it's still significant because there's a lot of people with chronic non-terminal pain, but it certainly decreased, and I think it's just one thing that can be done, and it certainly helped at Conackamack Hospital.
You're sort of on the front lines of these two very complicated issues of pain and addiction. Do you see any easy solutions, or do we have many years left to figure these things out?
Solutions, no. I see, you know, ways of managing problems. Our Chronic Opiate Therapy Committee is one way that this kind of issue can be managed. There are all kinds of new treatments that are available. They all have risks and benefits. You know, they need to be individualized as far as who is a good candidate for one or any of them. I think there's a lot to this issue that is difficult to look at from just a medical point of view.
Dr. Mitch Horan, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Tim Sands is the area management biologist for the Nooshinggak Commercial Fishing District. He sat down here this week to discuss his intentions to change the management scheme this coming season. Sands says he intends to open the drift fleet on the flood tide rather than fishing them on the ebb.
I think it's what the people want. You know, I've been the manager since 2003. And when I started in 2003, we started doing things a certain way. And
that certain way is ebb fishing.
Primarily fishing on the ebb. It's, we've evolved this fishing method over the years, and one of my main goals is to listen to the people and try and, within the constraints of the job, you know, managing for escapement, managing for allocation, to try and do it the way the majority of the people want.
Now, you're hearing from people that do want that, but over the years, this pushback now to fish some flood, it really came to a head at the AC meeting, ahead of Board of Fish, the Nooshinggak AC meeting. But before that, the feedback you thought you'd been hearing, I've heard you mention before, was more favorable.
Right. That was my impression all along, was people at first were like, what? And then by the end of that first season, they're like, this does work, you know? It eliminates the line fishing and allows the people that are good fishermen to go out and fish, to scrape the bars and to use the local knowledge and experience to do well, instead of the biggest, meanest bully with the biggest, baddest boat on the line to do well.
Do you think that this affects the set netters throughout the district to one way or the other?
Certainly, I think fishing on the ebb or taking a good chunk of the flood off allowed fish to come into the district and disperse. And that was a part of the motivation, because we are obligated to try and manage for allocation. It seemed to work. And, you know, one of the other things that is important in all this is the size of the runs we've had. We've had tremendous runs since 2003. The first, 2003 to 2010, all those runs were in the top 15.
Meaning that they were easy for you to manage and easy for people to harvest a decent season.
Meaning that there was lots of fish, and that we had to fish a lot to control the escapement. By fishing a lot to control the escapement, that means you're fishing two tides a day. A lot of the feedback I've gotten is, we just want to fish one tide a day. We want to be like Igigig.
Well, let me ask you that then. What is the feedback? Why are people asking to fish the flood?
The way I see it is, right now, for the last 3 years at least, we've been trying to, we fish on the ebb, primarily around the ebb, but when we were fishing for more than 6 hours, we would try and start fishing 2 hours before high tide. So 2 hours, the last 2 hours of the flood, and then ebb, right? The general message I got was that people didn't like that. That wasn't enough. They wanted more flood. So the whys and the wherefores vary from person to person, I'm sure. But the general message that we got at the Board of Fish meeting and at the advisor committee meeting was, we're not happy with what you're doing now because it's not enough flood. We want more flood.
Okay. What problems do you envision may come out of this? I definitely have heard from wildlife troopers over the past couple of years that they issue a lot less tickets in the Nooshkak District because people aren't banging the line. Do you think that that might be one result? Or
certainly that could be a result. I mean, I always thought that that was one of the benefits of fishing on the ebb was that there wasn't the line fishery. Obviously, we still need to manage for allocation, so I would envision that we'd only be fishing that 1 8-hour period a day because we have to take the other flood off to get fish into the set netters. Now, if it's we have a 10 million run, one of the biggest runs ever forecast for the Nooshkak District, will we be able to control 10 million run just fishing one tide a day? I don't know. You know, it seems unlikely to me because we've not been able to control the other runs that we've had that were smaller even than this by fishing two tides a day. You know, as far as I'm concerned, this all comes from the fishermen. The fishermen say they're going to catch more fish and do better by fishing on the flood. Well, so they're the experts. I can only, you know, say, hey, all right, I'll give it a try your way.
Tim Sands, good to talk with you.
Thanks, Dave. Always a pleasure.
This is KDLG's Bristol Bay and Beyond. Over the past 2 weeks, we've been seeing photos of a mural in progress from a resident Bristol Bay artist, Abayu Moore. Moore received a grant from the state's Percent for Arts program to paint 2 65-foot murals that will be shipped up to Bethel next fall to be installed in the youth detention center there. Moore spoke with KDLG's Hannah Colton this week about this latest mural project, how her art has changed in recent years, and her hopes for the community of artists in Bristol Bay.
My name is Abayu Moore, and I'm painting this mural for the Bethel Youth Facility at the Olecnagik City Shop. So the reason why it looks so bright is because purple and orange are complementary colors, and that was one of the ideas behind the whole mural, is that the colors complement each other and they make you happy. It's their juvenile detention center, and so a lot of the kids that will be using that area are from the Bethel area. And last year, all the pictures from up there with all of the salmon berry fields were pretty inspiring, and just trying to keep it positive and remind them what awaits. I don't know, are you a good berry picker, or sometimes you get kind of lazy? I'm sort of a lazy berry picker. I will sit there, I'll pick, and then I'll sit there and I'll just admire how gorgeous it is outside. And so that was one of the first ideas with it, is just what it feels like to actually be sitting in a berry patch and how beautiful it is. Murals are so much quicker than doing a regular painting. Yeah, the size of it, you don't have to get as meticulous with the details. You know, a big blob on there is actually a nice little speck of detail on a mural. But if you made that same mark on a painting that's 16 by 20, then you kind of screwed the thing up. And so I love this because it seems like it goes by really fast. You see progress right away, and it's instant gratification. You just feel like you're accomplishing big things. And I like to feel like that. Well, I was an athlete before I was an artist. I'd say my art teacher in high school would probably say I was kind of arrogant too. But that also, I know that played in with sports because I wanted to be as good as the boys. And so I got as, you know, just as good as the guys about talking trash. You know, just I'd talk a lot of smack and say that I was going to sell paintings for millions when I didn't really believe that I was going to, but just the fun of talking smack was... I've slowed down a little bit, quite a bit. people tell you parenting could be hard. It's such a reward, and you find so much inspiration from them at the same time. Kaya just turned 4, and Bodhi will be 2 in May. I don't know if it's the hormones from being a mom or what, but you just get way more emotional. So I think my work has definitely turned a little bit more emotional over the years. Yeah, it has, because I was pretty funny with my first works. Like, I have the Salmon Sex series and, you know, kind of working off of that. And then now it gets into moms and babies in their wombs and salmon. And, oh, my God, my life is right here. And it's, I need to show everyone my feelings. I could feel it when I start getting a little bit crazy, and then I'll have to put up the flag and say, hello. Today is my painting day for sanity. That's sort of how we've been working. But, you know, as like you said, the kids are getting older, and so they're also able to play with each other a little bit more and occupy themselves. And if I give Kaya a paintbrush and paper too, then she'll distract herself while I'm painting and then look at what I'm doing and paint along with me. So that's been nice. I'm finally getting into the phase where I'm identifying with Elekhniqik a lot more. The mayor suggested that I invite the school kids over. I love it when people stop by. I like it when people are inspired by this, or even when they start getting competitive, it makes it even better, because I know that's how I started, was looking at what other people were doing and realizing what they were getting paid for it and thinking, well, gosh, I might be able to do that better. And so I'd like people to think that way, especially in Dillingham. I want the art community to really step it up. It'd be cool to have some young, sassy artists start really, you know, throwing some pizzazz out there, getting us motivated to do some stuff. Maybe there'll be something that makes you think a little bit more, you know? Maybe someone will go off of what I've been doing and go the opposite and try to get people thinking about how to make other changes. Like, I might be missing something just because I'm into subsistence and fishing and things like that. What else is there that we love about this area? Or what else is there to say about Bristol Bay? I think it'd be cool to see someone else's mural up.
Last year, about this time, we invited our friend and regular guest Gabe Dunham in to talk about some maintenance when pulling boats out for the spring. Dunham is the Marine Advisory Program agent in Bristol Bay and is a seasoned marine mechanic who teaches a wildly popular outboard motor repair class all over the state. Well, the swans are showing up at Elekhniqik. Pintails are zipping overhead, and I don't know about you, but I've already swatted 2 mosquitoes. Gabe offered to run through the same spring tips, but this year, making use of yesterday's nice weather and my 16-foot skiff with a 40-horse Mercury jet. She's no beaut, and to be honest, I never got around to winterizing last year, but Gabe said she'd do just fine for instructional purposes.
So really, before you do all this stuff, the first thing I like to start out with is a good visual inspection. You know, cowling comes off. I'm going to look for any sign of chafing, any loose electrical connections. Right away, we see here we've got one red wire that looks like it might be rubbing on a piece of metal. So I'm just going to grab my screwdriver and move it over so it's not getting pinched or anything. And I think we're looking good right there. And I'm just going to walk around the whole motor and look for any obvious signs of something wrong. The visual inspection is really where you're going to catch a lot of your problems before they become real problems on the water. So the other thing I want to do, that's just part of the visual inspection, is to go around to the controls in the front and just actuate them. We're going to see if this thing shifts into gear. And while we're shifting it, we're going to see if these cables feel overly stiff. They don't feel too badly. Of course, you have to account for whether or not you've got the cable friction adjusted on your control box, and I think this one does. There's a little bit of stiffness in that throttle cable, but so that's something I might look into further. The other thing I'm going to do is grab the steering wheel and see if it steers back and forth, see if that steering cable is seized up, and this one's nice and free, so we're good there. And that's all part of the visual check.
Gabe's a systems guy, working his way in line, sort of front to back. After a good look at the controls and underneath the cowling, we get to the electricals.
So to check this battery, what we've got here is a marine battery with removable caps. So we're going to pop these caps off and see if we've got water in here. And take a look at that. And this battery is full. You can tell when a battery is full because the cells have this plastic casing that goes down inside the cell, and the water level should be right even with the bottom of that casing, and it is on this battery. So we're good to go here. Don't need to add any water there. But if we did, we'd be using some distilled water. The minerals in regular tap water will cause problems with the lead cells inside. So we'll put these caps back on.
Okay.
All right. The next thing I want to do is, like I said, I'm going to take a pair of pliers or a wrench and check and make sure that these nuts holding our battery connections on are nice and tight for a couple reasons. First, you don't really want those coming off when you're running down the lake. And the other reason is that if they do come off, you can create sparks in your boat. And that's never a good thing because you can have some stray fuel fumes and create a fire hazard.
Okay, so electrical at this point checks out.
Yep, looks good. And the last thing I'll do with the electrical is just make sure that some of these accessories are working. I'll try the trim and tilt, which works fine. I'll turn the key on, see if we get a warning alarm. Yep, that's there. And I'll just blip the starter real quick to see if that starter motor's working, which it is. Okay. So that checks out.
Good sound to hear.
Yes, it is.
From electrical, it's on to fuel, where Gabe says most outboard issues occur.
So the first thing I'm going to check for in the fuel system is potential water in the fuel. Water can get there a couple different ways. Obviously, if you've got a leaking fuel tank from the top, maybe one of the gaskets on the fuel isn't quite up to snuff. The other place that water can come from is just condensation. So through the natural heating and cooling of the tank, you can get a little bit of water in there. So if it's a plastic tank, I usually just tilt it on its edge. I'll take off the fuel cap. I'm going to take a flashlight and I'll tilt this tank up on its edge and shine the light in there and see if I can see any water collect at the bottom corners. And if I can, then I'll take usually just another piece of fuel hose with a primer bulb and reach down there and just suck that little bit of water out and dispose of it. I don't see any water in this tank. This is pretty fresh fuel we just put in here, so we know it's clean. Put that cap back on. The next spot you want to check for water is your Raycor. This boat's got a transom mounted Raycor filter, so it's got a little screw on the bottom, a little thumb screw that you can loosen. So I'll just take a piece of paper towel, put it in my hand, and I'll loosen that drain on the bottom of this Raycor just enough to see what comes out the bottom of it. I drained a little bit, maybe like a quarter of a teaspoon into this paper towel. And I'm looking at it, and all I see is fuel. I don't see any water drops or anything like that. So I think we're good to go there. And that's about it. I mean, if a motor's been sitting for a long time, I might drain the carburetors and flush fuel with the primer bulb through the carburetors. But we know this one should be just fine to start right up.
This outboard doesn't have water intake vents on the lower unit, so we put the jet foot in a big tote full of water and gave her a crank.
Sounds all right. It sounds like it's running on all four cylinders. We've got a good solid indicator stream coming out of the cowling there. And a typical amount of smoke that we expect out of a two-cycle engine. We're going to let it run for a little while.
Start to finish, Gabe's preseason motor maintenance run-through took us less than an hour.
Yeah, so to sum it up, we basically went through the major systems on this boat. We checked the fuel system for water. We checked the controls. We did a good visual inspection on the power head, underneath the cowling. We checked the electrical system. We checked to make sure if there was water in the battery and that the connections were tight. We also test ran the motor. The motor ran good. We came up to temperature with it, and it started right up when it was up on temperature. So that's really what you're looking for. Besides that, I think we're ready to go boating. We'll be right back.
Gabe Dunham is the Marine Advisory Program Agent for Bristol Bay. And that's it for this week's show. You can find this and past episodes of Bristol Bay and Beyond at our website, kdlg.org. Send feedback and ideas to news@kdlg.org. I'm Dave Benninger. My thanks to Molly Dishner and Hannah Colton. We hope to see you back here next week.